The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I am the Assistant Director of the Author Events Program. I am honored to be here this evening to introduce Danielle Evans and Tayari Jones. Danielle Evans burst onto the literary scene in 2007 when her short story, Virgins, appeared in the Paris Review. Her debut collection of short stories, Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self, presents a heartrending and clear depiction of coming of age in 21st century America, with vivid characters who span boundaries of race, class, relationships, and family, focusing on the transitory awkwardness inherent to young adulthood. Praised by Salman Rushdie as a literary prodigy, Evans is a professor of literature and creative writing at American University and a graduate of Columbia University and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Her writing has appeared in two volumes of Best American Short Stories and in magazines, including the Paris Review and A Public Space. Tayari Jones is a novelist and short story writer whose fiction often focuses on the urban South, namely Atlanta. Her first novel, Leaving Atlanta, received Best of the Year nods from The Washington Post, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and won the Hurston Wright Award for debut fiction. Her second novel, The Untelling, won the Lillian Smith Award from the Southern Regional Council. She holds degrees from Spelman College, Arizona State University, and the University of Iowa, and is currently on the MFA faculty at Rutgers. From the opening line of Silver Sparrow, she unveils a story about a man's deception, a family's complicity, and two teenage girls who imagine themselves growing up to be nothing like their mothers. It is a pleasure and an honor to have them here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Danielle Evans first.
Hi, thank you all for coming out on a Tuesday night. I was just realizing yesterday I've been in Philadelphia for longer than 3 hours, so someday I'll actually get to see the beautiful city. But tonight I'm glad to see you all, and Tayari, who I'm following around this week, but she's a good person to follow around. So I haven't read this story in like 3 years because I got mad at it, because for a while it was the only thing anyone would ask me to read, and I just said, no, I'm not going to do it anymore. But I've forgiven the story, so hopefully you will too. I'm going to read, unfortunately there's this persistent rumor that I'm a short story writer, but I'm actually kind of a long story writer. Since it's just rude to read it anybody for long enough to read an entire long story, I'm going to read you about half of a story called Virgins. Me and Jasmine and Michael were hanging out at Mr. Thompson's pool. We were 15, and it was the first weekend after school started, and me and Jasmine were sitting side by side on one of Mr. Thompson's ripped-up green and white lawn chairs, doing each other's nails while the radio played Me Against the World. It was the day after Tupac got shot, and even Hot 97, which hadn't played any West Coast for months, wasn't playing anything else. Jasmine kept complaining that Michael smelled like bananas. Sunscreen, Jasmine said, is some white people shit. That's them white girls you've been hanging out with got you wearing sunscreen. Black people don't burn. Never mind that Michael was lighter than Jasmine, and I was lighter than Michael, and really all three of us burned. Earlier, when Jasmine had gone to the bathroom, I'd let Michael rub sunscreen gently into my back. I guess I smelled like bananas, too, but I couldn't smell anything but the nail polish. And I didn't think she could, either. Jasmine was on about some other stuff. You smell like food, Jasmine said. I don't know why you want to smell like food. Nobody here's going to lick you because you smell like bananas. Maybe that works in Bronxville, but not with us. I don't want you to lick me, Michael said. I don't know where your mouth has been. I know you don't ever shut it. Shut up, I said. They were my only two real friends, and if they fought, I'd have had to fix it. I turned up the dial on Mr. Thompson's radio, which was big and old. The metal had deep scratches on it and rust spots left by people like us, who didn't watch to see whether or not we'd flick drops of water on it. It had a good sound, though. When the song was over, they cut to some politician from the city, saying again that it was a shame talented young black people kept dying like this, and it was time to do something about it. They'd been saying that all day. Mr. Thompson got up and cut off the radio. You live like a thug, you die like a thug, he said, looking at us. It's nothing to cry over when people wake up in the beds they made. He was looking for an argument, but I didn't say nothing, and Jasmine didn't either. Part of swimming in Mr. Thompson's pool was that he was always saying stuff like that. It still beat swimming at the city pool, which had closed for the season last weekend, and before that had been closed for a week after someone got beat up there. When it was open, it was crowded and dirty from little kids who peed in it, and it was usually full of people who were always trying to start something. People like Michael who had nothing better to do. I'm not crying for nobody, Michael told Mr. Thompson. Tupac been dead to me since he dissed B.I.G. He looked up and made some bootleg version of the sign of the cross, like he was talking about God or something. He must have seen it in a movie. Mr. Thompson shook his head at us and walked back to the lawn chair where he'd been reading the paper. He let it crinkle loudly when he opened it again, like even the sound of someone else reading would make us less ignorant. Jasmine snorted. She lifted Michael's sweatshirt with the tips of her thumb and index finger so she didn't scratch her still drying polish and pulled out the pictures he'd been showing us before Mr. Thompson came over. Photos of his latest girlfriend, a brunette with big eyes and enormous breasts, sitting on a bed with a lot of ruffles on it. You live like a white girl, you act like a white girl, said Jasmine, frowning at the picture and making her voice like she was Mr. Thompson. She's not white, said Michael. She's Italian. Jasmine squinted at the girl's penny-sized pink nipples. She looked white to me. She's Italian, said Michael. Italian people ain't white. No. What the fuck are they then? Italian? Mr. Thompson, Jasmine called across the yard. Are Italian people white? Ask the Ethiopians, said Mr. Thompson, and none of us knew what the hell he was talking about, so we all shut up for a minute. The air started to feel cooler through our swimsuits, and Michael got up, putting his jeans on over his wet swim trunks and pulling his sweatshirt over his head. I followed Jasmine into the house where we took turns changing in the downstairs bathroom. It was an old house like most of the ones in his part of town, but Mr. Thompson kept it nice. The wallpaper was peeling a little, but the bathroom was clean. The soap in the soap dish was shaped like a seashell, and it seemed like we were the only ones who ever used it. On our way out, we said goodbye to Mr. Thompson, who nodded at us and grunted, girls, then harsher, at Michael, boy. Michael rolled his eyes. Michael wasn't bad. Mostly, I thought he hung out with us because he was bored a lot. He needed somebody to chill with when the white girls he was fucking's parents were home. We didn't get him in trouble as much as his boys did. We hung out with him because we figured it was easier to have a boy around than not to. Strangers usually thought one of us was with him, and they didn't know which, so they didn't bother either of us. When you were alone, men were always wanting something from you. We even wondered about Mr. Thompson sometimes, or at least we never went swimming at his house without Michael with us. Mr. Thompson was retired, but he used to be our elementary school principal, which is how he was the only person in Mount Vernon we knew with a swimming pool in his backyard. We, and everybody else we knew, lived on the south side, where it was mostly apartment buildings, and if you had a house, you were lucky if your backyard was big enough for a plastic kiddie pool. The bus didn't go by Mr. Thompson's house, and it was a 20-minute walk from our houses, even if we walked fast, but it was nicer than swimming at the city pool, and we were the only ones he told could use it any time. It's because I collected more than anyone else for the fourth-grade can drive when we got computers, I said. He likes me. Nah, Jasmine said. He doesn't remember that. It's because my mom worked at the school all those years. Jasmine's mom had been one of the lunch ladies, and we'd gone out of our way to pretend not to know her, with her hair not cutting a line into her broad forehead, her face all covered in sweat. Even when she got home, she'd smell like grease for hours. Sometimes, if my mother made me a bag lunch, I'd split it with Jasmine so we didn't have to go through the lunch line and hear the other kids laugh. At school, Mr. Thompson had been nicer to Jasmine's mother than we had. We felt bad for letting Mr. Thompson make us nervous. He was the smartest man either of us knew, and probably he was just being nice. We were not stupid, though. We'd had enough nice guys suddenly look at us the wrong way. My first kiss was with a boy who said he'd walk me home, and a block later was licking my mouth. The first time a guy had ever touched me, like touched me there, I was 11 and he was 16 and a lifeguard at the city pool. We'd been playing chicken and when he put me down, he held me against the cement and put his fingers in me, and I wasn't scared or anything, just cold and surprised. When I told Jasmine later, she said he did that to everyone, her too. Michael kept people like that out of our way. People used to say that he was sleeping with us or trying to, but it wasn't like that. He was our friend and he moved on to girls from Bronxville anyway. It was like he didn't even see us like girls sometimes, and that felt nice, because mostly everybody else did. Michael's brother Ron was leaned up against his car, waiting for him at the bottom of Mr. Thompson's hill. The car was a brown Cadillac that was older than Ron, who graduated from our high school last spring and worked at Radio Shack. People didn't usually notice the car much, because they were too busy looking at Ron and he knew it. He was golden-colored with curly hair and doll baby eyelashes and the kind of smile where you could count all of his teeth. Jasmine always said how fine he was, but to me, he looked like the kind of person who should be on television, not someone you'd actually want to talk to. He must have still been mad at Pac 2, where he was just tired of hearing him on the radio because he was playing Nas from the tape deck. Michael hopped in the front seat and started to wave bye to us. "Man," Ron said, cuffing him on the back of his head, "you got two cute girls here and you're not even going to try to take them with you? I thought I raised you better than that." "I'm meeting people at the Galleria. You coming?" Michael called. "Who's going to be there?" Jasmine asked. "Me, Darius, Eddie, probably some other people." "Mm-mm," Jasmine said. "You're cool, but your boy ain't." "What's wrong with my boy?" Michael asked, grinning. Jasmine made a sound. "He ignorant, that's what." "Damn," said Ron as he walked back to the driver's side, "your whole crew can't get play." He got in, slammed the car door, and did a U-turn. On his way past us, he leaned out the window and called, "You get tired of messing with these fools, you come down to the mall and see me." Then rolled up the amber window and drove off. Jasmine's problem was that she had lost her virginity to Michael's friend Eddie 4 months before. He told her he would go with her afterward, but instead he went with Cindy Jackson. We saw them all over the city all summer, holding hands. It drove Jasmine crazy. Jasmine liked to pretend no one knew any of this, even though "Jasmine fucked Eddie and now she's pressed" had been written in both the boys' and girls' bathrooms at school for months. Cindy wrote it in both places. I told Jasmine Cindy was probably real familiar with the boys' bathroom. "The only difference between that girl and the subway," I said, "is that everybody in the world hasn't ridden the subway." I thought Jasmine would feel better, but instead of laughing, she just sniffled and said, "He left me for some trashy bitch." After that, I just let her cry. On her way to Jasmine's house, she said, "I'm sad about Tupac a little. It is sad. You can't ever do anything. I bet you if I got famous, somebody would kill me too." "What the hell would you get famous for?" I asked. "I'm just saying, if I did." "Sure," I said, "you'd be just like Tupac." "I'm just saying, Erica, you never know. You don't know what could happen. You don't know how much time you got." Jasmine could be melodramatic like that, thinking because something bad happened somewhere, something bad would happen to you. I remember when Tupac had gone to jail and Jasmine cried because she said we could get arrested too, and I said, "For what?" But it didn't matter. She just kept crying. Mostly to make her feel better, we had bought "It's a Setup, So Keep Your Head Up" t-shirts at the mall. My mother screamed when she saw us wearing them. "Setup," she said. "Y'all take that crap off. Keep believing everything rap stars tell you. I'm telling you, the minute a man says someone set him up for anything, you run, because he's about to set you up for something." There were a whole lot of men we were supposed to stay away from, according to my mother. Rap stars, NBA players, white men. We didn't really know any of those kinds of people. We only knew boys like Michael, who freestyled a little but mostly not well, who played ball violently like someone's life was at stake, or else too pretty, flexing for the girls every time they made a decent shot, because even they knew they would never make the NBA, and we were all they were going to get out of a good game. The only white men we knew were teachers and cops, and no one had to try to tell us to stay away from them when that was all we did in the first place, but my mother was always worried about something she didn't need to be. When we got to Jasmine's apartment, we went straight to her room, which felt almost like it was my room, too. We lived two blocks from each other and slept at each other's houses as much as we slept at our own. My school books were still piled on the corner of her floor. My second bathing suit was hanging over her desk chair where I left it to dry last weekend. Me and Jasmine always shared everything, and after I showered, I went through Jasmine's closet like I would have gone through mine, looking for something to wear out later. Only this year was sharing things getting to be a problem because we were starting to be built different. I put on a pair of Jasmine's jeans, which were tied around my hips, and she told me so. "Look at you stretching out my jeans with your big old butt," was what she actually said. "You wish you had my butt," I said, which was true she did, because hers was flat like a board and people teased her about it. Jasmine was small, but all the meat she had on her was settled in her tummy, which was a cute little puff now, but would be a gut someday if she ever got fat. It made me happy sometimes to think that even though Jasmine's face was better than mine, if I ever got fat, I'd get fat the way my mother had, all on the hips and chest, and some people would still be all right with that, more than if I had a big giant stomach like Jasmine might one day. We weren't bad-looking, neither one of us. We weren't ever going to be beautiful either. I knew that already. We were the kind of girls who would always be very pretty if, but if never seemed to happen. If Jasmine's skin cleared up and she could keep her hair done and she did something about her teeth, which were a little crooked, and if I lost 5 pounds and got contact lenses and did something about the way my skin was always ashy, maybe we'd be the prettiest girls in Mount Vernon, but we weren't. We were just us. Jasmine had beautiful dark eyes and the most perfect nose I ever saw in anybody, and I had nice lips and a pretty good shape, and that was it. We got dressed to go to the movies because there was nothing else to do. And even though Jasmine's pants were a little tight on me and the shirt I borrowed was pushing up my chest and my face, I looked all right. Just maybe like I was trying too hard. And I will stop there and give you to lovely tired.
It's always a pleasure to read with Danielle. She is, I think, the greatest writer of her generation. I'm going to read from Silver Sparrow, my new novel. It begins with a poem by Natasha Trethewey. A daughter is a colony. A territory, a progeny, a spitting image like Athena sprung from her father's head, chip off the old block, issue and spawn, a namesake, a wishbone, loyalist and traitor, a native, an other, a subject, a study, a history, a half-blood, a continent dark and strange. Chapter 1, The Secret. My father, James Witherspoon, is a bigamist. He was already married 10 years when he first clamped eyes on my mother. In 1968, she was working at the gift wrap counter at Davis's downtown when my father asked her to wrap the carving knife he had bought his wife for their wedding anniversary. Mother says she knew that something wasn't right between a man and a woman when the gift was a blade. I said that maybe it means there was some kind of trust between them. I love my mother, but we tend to see things a little bit differently. The point is that James's marriage was never hidden from us. James is what I call him. His other daughter, Charisse, the one who grew up in the house with him, she calls him Daddy, even now. When most people think of bigamy, if they think of it at all, they imagine some primitive practice taking place on the pages of National Geographic. In Atlanta, we remember one sect of the Back to Africa movement that used to run bakeries in the West End. Some people said it was a cult. Others called it a cultural movement. Whatever it was, it involved four wives for each husband. The bakeries have since closed down, but sometimes we still see the women, resplendent in white, trailing six humble paces behind their mutual husband. Even in Baptist churches, ushers keep smelling salts on the ready for the new widow confronted at the wake by the other grieving widow and her stair-step kids. Undertakers and judges know that it happens all the time, and not just between religious fanatics, traveling salesmen, handsome sociopaths, and desperate women. It's a shame that there isn't a true name for a woman like my mother, Gwendolyn. My father, James, is a bigamist. That's what he is. Laverne is his wife. She found him first, and my mother has always respected the other woman's squatter's rights. But was my mother his wife, too? She has legal documents and even a single Polaroid proving that she stood with James Alexander Witherspoon, Jr. in front of a judge just over the state line in Alabama. However, to call her only his wife doesn't really explain the full complexity of her position. There are other terms I know, and when she is tipsy, angry, or sad, Mother uses them to describe herself: concubine, whore, mistress, consort. There are just so many, and none are fair. And there are nasty words, too, for a person like me, the child of a person like her. But these words were not allowed in the air of our home. You are his daughter. End of story. If this was ever true, it was in the first 4 months of my life before Charisse, his legitimate daughter, was born. My mother would curse at hearing me use that word, legitimate. But if she could hear the other word that formed in my head, she would close herself in her bedroom and cry. In my mind, Charisse is his real daughter. With wives, it only matters who gets there first. With daughters, the situation is a bit more complicated. It matters what you call things. Surveil is my mother's word. If he knew, James would probably say spy, but that's too sinister. We didn't do damage to anyone but ourselves as we trailed Charisse and Laverne as they wound their way through their easy lives. I had always imagined that we would eventually be asked to explain ourselves, to press words forward in our own defense. On that day, my mother would be called upon to do the talking. She is gifted with language and is able to layer difficult details in such a way that the result is smooth as water. She is a magician who can make the whole world feel like a dizzy illusion. The truth is a coin she pulls from behind your ear. Maybe mine was not a blissful girlhood, but is anyone's? Even people whose parents are happily married to each other and no one else, even these people have their share of unhappiness. They spend plenty of time nursing old slights, rehashing squabbles. So, you see, I have something in common with the whole world. My mother didn't ruin my childhood or anyone's marriage. She is a good person. She prepared me. Life, you see, is all about knowing things. That is why my mother and I shouldn't be pitied. Yes, we have suffered, but we never doubted that we enjoyed at least one peculiar advantage when it came to what really mattered. I knew about Charisse. She didn't know about me. My mother knew about Laverne, but Laverne was under the impression that hers was an ordinary life. We never lost track of that basic and fundamental fact. When did I first discover that although I was an only child, my father was not my father and mine alone? I really can't say. It's something that I've known for as long as I've known I had a father. I can only say for sure when I learned this type of double-duty daddy wasn't ordinary. I was about 5 years old in kindergarten when the art teacher, Miss Russell, asked us to draw pictures of our families. While all the other children scribbled with their crayons or soft leaded pencils, I used a blue ink pen and drew James, Charisse, and Laverne. In the background was Raleigh, my father's best friend, the only person we knew from his other life. I drew him with the crayon labeled Flesh because he's really light-skinned. This was years and years ago, but I still remember. I hung a necklace around the wife's neck. I gave the girl a big smile stuffed with square teeth. In the margin, I drew my mother and me standing by ourselves. With a marker, I blacked in mother's long hair and curving lashes. On my own face, I drew only a pair of wide eyes. The art teacher approached me from behind. "Now, who are these people you've drawn so beautifully?" Charmed, I smiled up at her. "My family. My daddy has two wives and two girls." Cocking her head, she said, "I see." I didn't think much more about it. I was still enjoying the memory of the way she pronounced beautifully. To this day, whenever I hear anyone say that word, I feel loved. At the end of the month, I brought all my drawings home in a cardboard folder. James opened up his wallet, which he kept plump with $2 bills to reward me for my schoolwork. I saved the portrait, my masterpiece, for last, being as it was so beautifully drawn and everything. My father picked the page up from the table and held it close to his face like he was looking for a coded message. Mother stood behind me, crossed her arms over my chest, and bent to place a kiss on the top of my head. "It's okay," she said. Did you tell your teacher who was in the picture?" James said. I nodded slowly, the whole time thinking that I probably should lie, although I wasn't quite sure why. "James," Mother said, "let's not make a molehill into a mountain. She's just a child." "Gwen," he said, "this is important. Don't look so scared. I'm not going to take her out behind the woodshed." Then he chuckled, but my mother didn't laugh. All she did was draw a picture. Kids draw pictures. "Gone in the kitchen, Gwen," James said. "Let me talk to my daughter." My mother said, "Why can't I stay in here? She's my daughter, too." "You're with her all the time. You tell me I don't spend enough time talking to her, so now let me talk." Mother hesitated, then released me. "She's just a little kid, James. She doesn't even know the ins and outs yet." "Trust me," James said. She left the room, but I don't know that she trusted him not to say something that would leave me wounded and broken-winged for life. I could see it in her face. When she was upset, she moved her jaw around invisible gum. At night, I could hear her in her room, grinding her teeth in her sleep. The sound was like gravel under car wheels. "Dana, come here." James was wearing a Navy chauffeur's uniform. His hat must have been in the car, but I could see the ridge mark across his forehead where the hat band usually rested. "Come closer," he said. I hesitated, looking to the space in the doorway where Mother had disappeared. "Dana," he said, "you're not scared of me, are you? You're not afraid of your own father, are you?" His voice sounded mournful, but I took it as a dare. "No, sir," I said, taking a bold step forward. "Don't call me Sir Dana. I'm not your boss. When you say that, it makes me feel like an overseer." I shrugged. Mother told me that I should always call him Sir. With a sudden motion, he reached out for me and lifted me up on his lap. He spoke to me with both our faces looking outward, so I couldn't see his expression. "Dana, I can't have you making drawings like the one you made for your art class. I can't have you doing things like that. What goes on in this house between your mother and me is grown people's business. I love you. You're my baby girl, and I love you, and I love your mama. But what we do in this house has to be a secret, okay? But I didn't even draw this house. James sighed and bounced me on his lap a little. What happens in my life, in my world, doesn't have anything to do with you. You can't tell your teacher that your daddy has another wife. You can't tell your teacher that my name is James Witherspoon. Atlanta ain't nothing but a country town, and everybody knows everybody. Your other wife and your other girl is a secret? I asked him. He put me down from his lap so we could look each other in the face. Nah, he said, you got it the wrong way around. Dana, you are the one that's the secret. Then he patted me on his head and tugged one of my braids. With a wink, he pulled out his billfold and separated three $2 bills from the stack. He handed them over to me, and I clamped them in my palm. Aren't you going to put them in your pocket? Yes, sir. And for once, he didn't tell me not to call him that. In the kitchen, my mother placed the bowls and plates on the glass table in silence. She wore her favorite apron that James brought back from New Orleans. On the front was a drawing of a crawfish holding a spatula aloft and a caption, "Don't make me poison your food." James took his place at the head of the table and polished the water spots from his fork with his napkin. I didn't lay a hand on her. I didn't even raise my voice now, did I? No, sir. And this was entirely the truth, but I felt different than I had just a few minutes before when I pulled my drawing out of its sleeve. My skin stayed the same, while this difference snuck in through a pore and attached itself to whatever brittle part forms my center. You are the secret. He said it with a smile, touching the tip of my nose with the pad of his finger. My mother came around and picked me up under my arms and sat me on a stack of phone books in my chair. Are you okay? I nodded. James ate his meal, spooning honey onto a dinner roll when my mother said there would be no dessert. He drank a big glass of Coke. Don't eat too much, my mother said. You know you have to eat again in a little while. I'm always happy to eat your food, Gwen, he said. I'm always happy to sit at your table. I don't know how I decided that my missing teeth were the problem, but I devised a plan to slide a folded piece of paper behind my top teeth to camouflage the pink space in the center of my smile. I was inspired by James, actually, who once told me how he had put cardboard in his shoes when he was little to make up for the holes in the soles. The paper was soggy, and the blue lines ran with my saliva. Mother caught me in the middle of this process. She walked into my room and lay across my twin bed. She liked to do this, just lie across my bed while I played with my toys or colored in my notebooks, watching me like I was a television show. What are you doing, Petunia? Don't call me Petunia, I said, partially because I didn't like the name and partially because I wanted to see if I could talk with paper in my mouth. Petunia is the name of a pig. Petunia is a flower, my mother said, a pretty one. It's Porky Pig's girlfriend. That's meant to be a joke, a pretty name for a pig, you see? A joke is supposed to be funny. It is funny. You're just in a bad mood. What are you doing with the paper? I'm trying to put my teeth back, I said, trying to rearrange the sodden wad. How come? This seemed obvious as I took in my own reflection along with my mother's in the narrow mirror attached to the top of my chest of drawers. Of course James wanted to keep me a secret. Who could love a girl with a gaping pink hole in the middle of her mouth? None of the other children in my kindergarten circle looked like I did. Surely my mother could understand this. She spent half an hour each night squinting at her skin before a magnifying mirror. When I asked her what she was doing, she said, I am improving my appearance. Wives can afford to let themselves go, but concubines must be vigilant. Recalling it now, I know she must have been drinking. Although I can't remember the moment so well, I know that just outside the frame was her glass of Asti Spumante, golden and busy with bubbles. I am improving my appearance, I said, hoping she would smile. Your appearance is perfect, Dana. You're 5. You have beautiful skin, shiny eyes, and pretty hair. But no teeth, I said. You're a little girl. You don't need teeth. Yes, I do, I said. I do. Why? To eat corn on the cob? Your teeth will grow back. There's lots of corn in your future. I want to be like that other girl, I said finally. Mm-hmm. mother had been lying across my bed like a goddess on a chaise lounge, but when I said that, she snapped up. What other girl? James's other girl. You can say her name, mother said. I shook my head. Can't. Yes, you can. Just say it. Her name is Charisse. Stop it, I said, afraid that just saying my sister's name would unleash some terrible magic, the way that saying Bloody Mary while staring into a pan of water would turn the liquid red and thick. Mother rose from the bed and got down on her knees so we were the same height. As she pressed her hands down on my shoulders, traces of cigarette smoke lingered in her tumbly hair. Her name is Charisse, my mother said again. She's a little girl, just like you are. Please stop saying it, I begged her. Stop it before something happens. My mother hugged me to her chest. What did your daddy say to you the other day? Tell me what he said. Nothing, I whispered. Dana, you can't lie to me, okay? I tell you everything and you tell me everything. That's the only way we can pull this off, baby. We got to keep the information moving between us. He said I was a secret. My mother pulled me into a close hug, crisscrossing her arms across my back and letting her hair hang around me like a magic curtain. That motherfucker, she said. I love him. You know I love him. But I might just have to kill him one day. The next morning, my mother told me to put on the green and yellow dress I'd worn for my school picture 6 weeks earlier before the teeth were lost. She styled my long hair with slippery ribbons and strapped my feet into stiff, shiny shoes. Then we climbed into my godmother's old Buick on loan for the day. Where are we going? Mother turned off Gordon Road. I'm taking you to see something. I waited for more information, poking my tongue into the slick space where my nice teeth had once been. She didn't say anything else about our destination, but she asked me to recite my at words. H-A-T is hat, B-A-T is bat. I didn't stop until I got to M-A-T is mat. By then, we pulled up in front of a small pink school building trimmed in green. Down the road was John A. White Park. We sat in the car a long time while I performed for her. I was glad to do it. I recited my numbers from 1 to 100. Then I sang Frère Jacques. When a group of children spilled out into the yard of the small school, my mother held up a finger to stop my singing. Roll down your window and look out, she said. You see that chubby little girl in the blue jeans and the red shirt? That's Charisse. I found the girl my mother described standing in a line with a group of other little kids. Charisse was utterly ordinary back then. Her hair was divided into two short puffs in the front, and the shorter hair in the back was held down with a series of tight braids. Look at her, my mother says. She hardly has any hair. She's going to be fat when she grows up, just like her mammy. She doesn't know her at words, and she cannot sing a song in French. I said, she has her teeth. For now, she's your same age, so they're probably loose. But here's something you can't see. She was born too early, so she has problems. The doctor had to stick plastic tubes down her ears to keep them from being infected. But James loves her. She's not a secret. James has an obligation to her mammy, and that's my problem, not yours, okay? James loves you equal to Charisse. If he had any sense, he'd love you best. You're smarter, more mannerable, and you've got better hair. But what you have is equal love, and that's good enough. I nodded as relief spread all over my body. I felt all my muscles relax. Even my feet let go and settled themselves limp in my pretty shoes. Am I a secret? I asked my mother. No, she said. You are an unknown. That little girl there doesn't even know that she has a sister, but you know everything. God knows everything, I said. He's got the whole world in his hands. That's true, my mother said. That is true. And so do we. Thank you.
Okay, I think everyone knows how this works. If you can raise your hand, the two ladies in the aisle will get a microphone to you. Please wait for the microphone. Who would like to start us off? How about right there?
Good evening, ladies. Tayari?
Yes.
And Danielle. Actually, this is a question for the both of you, because I actually was thinking about it while you were reading each of your selections. Do you remember your books verbatim, or do you, like, lose it if you haven't been away from it been at it for a while and then go back and it comes back to you?
No, I think that the more that I read, the farther I get from the actual text. There's a... There's a way in which when you read a story sometimes, especially when you're coming back to something that you wrote a long time ago, the story exists differently in your head than it does on the page. So sometimes you end up kind of rewriting it as you go, not completely, but a word here, a sentence there, but for the most part, I'm reading.
I do think that by the time you're reading a story, it's so far away because the book has been in production a couple years. You know, so by the time you have it in your hand, it's something you wrote 2 years ago. But I think I do edit as I read aloud. And also, I think there are certain things on the page. Don't you think there are cues on the page that tell the reader what's happening? But you have to do it differently when you read it aloud. Because, like, for example, a paragraph break, you have to pitch it with your voice in a different kind of way. So it's going to be slightly different in my verbal interpretation than it is in the book.
Next question. How about right over on the other side there with the bandana?
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. Both of you read about young characters, young girls or young women. And why was that? Do you ever write about, you know, maybe older women, middle-aged women, senior women? Or is there a reason that, you know, you both chose young girls?
I mean, I think the lucky thing about writing a short story collection is that you get to kind of go all over the place. So you always kind of pick where you're going to start. So that just happened to be one of the stories that was about a teenage character. But I think there are lots of reasons why teenagers make really great fiction. One is I had a teacher once who said that if you wanted to write fiction, what you had to do was take a character and put them in a situation where they said yes to everything to which a reasonable person would say no. Because that's what makes fiction more interesting than real life. And I don't know, that's probably like, as all absolutes, a rule that you break more than you follow. But there's a way in which teenagers really lend themselves to that kind of writing, that kind of like, let's see how the drama unfolds. Let's either start with a situation and think what would have happened if somebody had said yes to that, or who would a person have to be to say yes to that? And often who that person would have to be is somebody who had kind of more ambition than sense, or a sense of their own vulnerability that was off somehow. So I think teenagers are really interesting in that way, especially in the short story form where something has to happen really quickly. Also, short stories in particular tend to be about the moments when something changes forever, and I find a lot of those moments happen as children, as teenagers. That moment when you suddenly are not a child is usually the first moment when something changes forever. You have that sense of what forever is, right? So there's a way in which the form lends itself to that. And also, I think just as a writer, women in general, girls in particular, are not taken very seriously, so it's fun to write stories in which you take them seriously, in which their concerns are weighted and their voices are authentic but still intelligent. So it's a fun thing to do, but it's not the only thing that I do.
By the end of the book, the characters in Silver Sparrow, they're about 30. They're really like kind of a retrospective narrator, and it goes through her life. But I share your commitment to taking seriously the lives of young women and girls and their point of view. And fiction also often works very well from the point of view of people who are on the margins. And there's no one really further on the margins than young girls. You know, their opinions are not taken seriously. They're considered unreliable. They're constantly being judged and told what to do, how to act, which makes them also good characters to push against something trying to control them, because there's no one more controlled in this world than teenage girls. So they always are pushing against a system, and I think they make really good characters. And agree, it's not all I write about, but it is one of my favorite narrative stances. And I think it's also something personal about revisiting that time, because it's full of what if. You think, if I personally as an individual had made a different turn, it's to be in that place. It's, the whole thing is like a choose your own adventure as a teenager all the time. Are you going to jump out of the window, walk out the door, you know, all the time like that. So it's really fun. But I do think also as I get older, they say that people tend to write about 10 years behind themselves, because you want to write something that you feel like you have a good grip on. Like, I don't tend to write about the issues that I grapple with today as a 40-year-old woman. I don't write about 40-year-old women because I haven't quite figured that out yet. I'm doing that. But I do feel that I can write confidently about women in their late 20s and early 30s. I feel like I understand that.
Enthusiast.
How about all the way over there on the left side, Kim, about, yeah.
Hi, my name is Selena, and I'll actually be 44, and I thought both of your books were great. I could actually visualize standing there, actually seeing the girl, and even in your book where you talked about the jeans and the butt out and all that. Great. Y'all did a great job. It was great.
Thank you. How about right here in Peach?
I'm so pleased to be here and see two young, successful, sharp, insightful black women. It's just a pleasure to see you guys both together. The question that I have is for Ms. Jones. Are you related to Pearl Cleage?
I am not related to Pearl, but she was my very first teacher. I met her when I was just a girl. I was probably 17 years old. I was a student at Spelman, and this is before Pearl got to be well-known, you know, before she wasn't even writing novels yet, you know, so this is before she was like Oprah's favorite poet. She was just like a hard-working woman writer who taught at Spelman. She just had like one class, and she let everyone sign up for the class that wanted to be in the class. So there were like 45 people in this classroom. There was no air conditioning. Now they have air conditioning. There was no air conditioning. It was hot. And we were all packed up in there. And she let us all stay, but she made us work hard. And it really changed my life. I felt like she taught me not only how to write a story, but how to take myself seriously. Before I met Pearl, I did not understand that I had witnessed anything that really mattered. I didn't know that my ideas mattered. And because of her, I was able to write my first book, called Leaving Atlanta, that was about growing up in Atlanta during the Atlanta child murders, because she taught me that I had witnessed history. So she changed my life, but she is not a relative of mine, but I see her as often as I can because I feel like she's the person that showed me how to be a writer.
Okay. Kim, how about over on the left, about 10 or 12 rows back?
Okay. What advice would you give to young women just starting out in college or maybe juniors about how to get published?
You know, I don't really give young people advice about publishing. I try to give them advice about writing and how to find their voice. I actually think that something we really need to look at is young people are getting professionalized so early. You know, when I was 19 years old, I did not know that publishing involved agents. You know, I had never heard of it. You know, I didn't know that. I was all about trying to figure out how to write. And I feel like people now want to know, how do I get my hypothetical book published? I always tell my students, I will talk publishing to them after their book is finished. When you have a draft in hand, I will talk to you about how you can publish this draft in your hand. But I don't want to talk about how to publish your hypothetical book you haven't written yet, because I feel like it encourages them to want to be published authors but not want to be writers. So I think if I was talking to a young person, I would say, what's your story about? Why is your story important? I would teach them how to honor their writing practice, how to learn how to get that time in, how to hear your own voice. I think that's what I would tell them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things about publishing. One is that even the people who know what they're doing in publishing don't know what they're doing. That, I mean, they'll tell you, like, they don't know what's going to make a book really successful. Every year there's something that wildly surprises people one way or the other in the way that it takes off or doesn't. There's a way in which it's a tricky science, and it's a hard thing to pin down. And so to try to write to that is almost guaranteed to fail, because what you think might be popular, but the rule is in publishing 1 year will not be the rule in 2 years. When I was in grad school, they were saying you wrote a short story collection. A, they were saying you should not write short story collections at all, which may be statistically true, but if I had thrown out my short story collection and tried to squeeze a novel into those 2 years, it would have been a very bad novel, because what I was interested in and drawn to and working on was the material I was writing, and so I just had to trust it. And also at the time, they were saying that if you're selling a short story collection, it has to have some kind of concrete theme. People don't like story collections that are like lots of different stories. And then the year that I graduated, a classmate put out a book where the stories were like kind of all over the place, and all the reviews were like, finally, someone writes a short story collection that shows range. And, you know, they were really excited about that. And it's just one of those things where they make up rules as they go along, kind of. And you have to make up rules as you go along, but they're for a different thing and for a different end. And the other thing about publishing is that there's a way in which, like, I feel really lucky that somebody wanted my second book before it existed. I feel really lucky that I have a job, but every time I actually sit down to write, I have to disengage myself from the fact that my entire life right now is a house of cards that rests on a second book. Because no book can, like, you can't write from that place. You can't write from a place where you owe people anything. You can't write from a place of obligation. You can't write from a place of fear. It just doesn't work. So I have to pretend that it's just my work. And so as long as your work actually is your work and you have some other way that you're sustaining yourself, which if you're in college, you probably do, then I would run with that because it's a luxury in some ways, although it's a liability in others. There's a way in which your work does purely belong to you in a way that it never will again once you have an agent or an editor or an audience, because then you have people who are invested in your work and to whom you owe something, and you have to forget that every time you sit the page because it can only be you and the page in the room.
How about right up front here?
Pardon me. Welcome to Philadelphia. But just an addendum to what you've heard there, certain things that you might like to remember if you are a writer thinking about getting published. Margaret Mitchell was rejected 38 times before someone said, gone with the wind. Let's take a chance on it, for example. Madeleine Longo was rejected 26 times before someone said, A Wrinkle in Time, we'll give it a shot. J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the original name of the first book, had been rejected 12 times and was about to be rejected a 13th, until the daughter of the 13th publisher told her father that she loved the book and begged him to give it a shot.
Sir, I just want to make sure you have a question.
No, just an addendum.
But, thanks.
So you might keep that in mind, as she said, they're making the rules up as they go along.
Okay, Allie, how about on the here, about 10 rows back?
Hi, women. Hello. Lovely to hear you. I'm a person who writes and believes in books and believes in reading and believes in physical libraries and physical books. And all of those things, you know, there's some challenge these days. Do you have any insights, comments, reflections about how to get people, how to encourage people to keep reading, especially books like you guys write? Because one of the other things I'm concerned about is the dynamics in publishing whereby, you know, you guys are refuting this, but, you know, people are more interested in, well, Madonna has written a book now. Or, you know, whoever, you know, you've got to be somebody with a name already to write a book, and then there's sales. So I'm sort of interested in how do we keep the revolution going in terms of people reading, people like you, and people reading at all. Thanks.
I mean, I think there's a way in which I trust, like, I have anxieties about physical books and libraries, but I don't have anxieties about narrative. I think that people will always need stories in some way. They will always need stories that sort of explain to them something about themselves and the world that they live in. And this has been attributed to so many people that I'm not even going to bother trying to tease out who the right person was, but I always think they say that the project of writing is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think there's a way in which whatever form they take will always need stories to do that. And I do think that there are special ways in which, I mean, I can't imagine my own childhood or for that matter adulthood without books. And so there's a way in which, like, I feel an urgent loyalty to that. But I also feel like it's just not in my best interest to have a lot of anxiety about what other people are doing with their cultural time. And so in a way, when I get really angry about, like, why is this book so blah, 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 I just think to myself, you know what? Madonna is paying my rent. Because a million people are going to read that book, and that's really what's keeping Penguin afloat. And it's going to be okay. Like, we're gonna work out some things where the people who need to find my work will be able to find it. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's just so much you can't control that I try to focus on what I can. And what I can is to try to make my writing mean something and to try to, like, find the people to whom I think that it will matter and talk to them and then to help them find the way that their writing matters. Because I think, you know, there are ways in which, I mean, I also teach literature. And what I find over and over again is, as much as I may sometimes, I threaten students sometimes, if you don't love this book, there's something wrong with you, and you have to leave. But no matter who the student is or what the class is or how much resistance they come to the material, they always find something that just kind of opens something up for them. And I get to see that over and over again. And I think that sort of being in that space as a teacher gives me some comfort about the world, that the students are still making those connections, that books still exist in some really meaningful way that I never... I don't know, the kids are all right, I think. I don't know that the world will be all right by the time they get to be adults, but that's kind of their job. My job is to prepare them.
I agree with that, but I also think there are some things that as individuals you can do to help sustain reading. I'm on a 50-city reading tour, and I'm doing all my readings at independent bookstores. I've been speaking a lot to people who run independent bookstores, and it has kind of changed my feelings about the question about the physical book. And one thing you can do, really, is to purchase your books from an independent bookstore to encourage your library to order books. People who run independent bookstores, they curate their books like a museum. They choose the books that they put in. If you think about most complaints that people have about bookstores are usually happening in a big chain store. Like a lot of African-American writers complain about the African-American section. You know, you get in there and it's only all one kind of book. That's not going to happen to you in an independent bookstore. That's corporate. That's someone in a corporate office deciding what all y'all need to read and pushing a button and all those books go to that shelf. But if you go to an independent bookstore, also you can talk to the person who owns the bookstore and say, you know, we'd like to see the new book by Danielle Evans. Like you can do that. You can make that change, and spending money locally stays in your community. You don't have that one click, you know, or save that 30%, but we're saving that 30% with the one click at our own expense. So that is one thing I say. Go to your independents, support your independents, and support your local library. Keep your library busy and full. Make it clear that there's a need for a library in this community. And I think that is the thing that we can do.
Just a note that the books for sale in the lobby are being sold by the Joseph Fox Bookshop, which is the oldest independent bookshop in Philadelphia. Great. So how about right on here, black shirt?
Thank you. I'm going to sneak in two questions. First for Danielle, I love the title of your book. And I was actually in a church sermon, and the minister quoted the poem that the book was from. And, you know, I'm all like, oh, my goodness, that's where it comes from. But I would just like you to, if you could just tell us, like, I don't know if it's in, I haven't read the book yet. I'm going to. But can you just talk a little bit about that title? Because I just think it's so hilarious. And then, is it Tiari. Tiari.
Yes.
Thank you. Can you just tell us also, for you, I just finished reading the, like, first two chapters of the book. And the first sentence of your book grab me. Where did you get the idea? I mean, where does one come up with, where, I just want to know where you got the idea to write about a bigamist. I mean, like, I'm just curious if you met one, if that was where the idea started, or, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, it lends itself to such great storytelling, but I'm just always curious, you know, a bigamist, it is fascinating. I just want to know how that, you know, sprung to mind.
Well, I'll tell you first, my daddy is not a bigamist. I have said that every day for the last 37 days that the book has been out. I actually started this book thinking about writing about sisters, not so much writing about bigamy. I was interested in this concept we have of half-sisters. I have a sister, and we have the same father. We have different mothers. My father is not a bigamist. There's not that kind of scandal in our family, but she did not grow up with me. She grew up in Louisiana. I grew up in Atlanta. So all my life, I knew I had a sister that was just outside my reach. And that was the thing emotionally that was driving me. But what you do when you, like, I believe that if you know what it is to be trapped in an elevator, you can write what it is to be trapped in a spaceship. You know, so you take the thing that troubles you in your own life and you kind of turn the heat up on it really high. And that's how you end up with your story. But I have to say that I call myself writing this book because I was thinking about my sister and what does it mean for us to be sisters and so far away. But now that the book is out, I realize that I was called to write this book because there are so many people all around us who live in the shadows, who can't say their father's names, who feel like they were born into shame. I get letters from people that say, I'm a silver sparrow. A man wrote me a letter and said, I'm a silver sparrow. And the reason he used the title of my book is because there is no dignified language for people who are born under these circumstances. And like Dana says in the book, it matters what you call things. And so there are all these people there who have so much shame, they can't even tell anybody, you know, who their parents are. And I feel like I hope this book brings some light on it. And the reason I bring it up to your question to ask me how I got my idea, I think we know what we're doing, but it's something bigger than us that knows what we're doing. And I think that's what happened with this book.
Oh, I forgot you asked me a question. Sorry. I just want to listen to Tahereh talk more. The title does come from a poem called The Bridge Poems by Donna Kate Russian, if you want to look it up, you haven't seen it already. But, you know, I first heard that poem in college, which was also the first time that I felt like I was giving myself permission and had been given permission to take myself seriously as a writer. And there's a section of the poem, let me see if I still remember it. I explain my mother to my father to my little sister to my brother to, the black church folks, I'm going to forget that section. But there's this idea that there's this way in which we're constantly explaining things, and I think all writing is an act of translation on some level, but I think in particular writing from any kind of marginalized position or voice is an extra kind of layer of translation, because you're not necessarily counting on the world to hear you in the way that you want to be heard. And so there was something really meaningful to me about thinking of that kind of, the section that I was trying to remember completely ends with, I do more translating than the goddamn UN. And I thought, you know, I often feel that way as a person, but also as a writer. And so it seemed to capture something about the idea of writing any kind of book, and also the idea of existing in the space that a lot of the characters exist in, which is a kind of intermediary space, where they're not having the same lives their parents did, but they're not divorced from those communities, or where they're somehow in some kind of space of transition or some kind of liminal space. And so it seemed to make sense to me, both thinking about being a writer, but also thinking about the book itself and what a lot of the stories were thinking about in terms of people who are having, they're going back and forth between roles that were demarcated somehow because of race or class or gender or what have you.
Okay. Allie, you'll go back.
Congratulations to you both on your successful books. And I'd like to ask you, as we know with African-American films that have problems in terms of distribution internationally, how have you found so far your experience has been with both your books in terms of domestic sales versus international sales, and how many languages thus far have your book been translated into?
Well, no one has bought the international rights to my books. If you'd like them,
you know, I haven't had any international rights either, and I've been told that African American stories are considered too American, or that our experience is like that people see African American existence, our existence, as an American problem. You see, like that. So anything like my first, but that was an American problem. And so I don't have any international rights either. I've been translated actually into Spanish because I met a Spanish translator and he took it on as his pet project and convinced them to let him do it, which is really different than going to the international book fairs and they scoop it up.
I've had individual stories translated into Danish and Hebrew. And I got to go because I went on this retreat in Denmark and they said they translated everybody's work, but it was...
I had an essay translated to Hebrew as well.
Right.
Yeah, we don't know what that's all about.
But actually, I'm going to pick on you because we're friends on the Twitter. And so that conversation you were having with Alexander Chi about even within the U.S. about the way that, and I'm forgetting how you phrased it because it was smarter, but that African-American narratives are seen as kind of private tragedies, but immigration narratives somehow take on this kind of world literature space?
Well, yes, that is true. Yeah, that if there is an African descended person that is not African American, then that story is considered bigger, larger, more meaningful. Yeah, and that the African American stories are just like, I don't know if our stories exist and are perceived as being in opposition to the culture, you know, like so that it's a problem, it's not for everyone. You know, like in that kind of way that you're not, that is considered very, like you're talking about your own home and it's not something that is for wider consumption. It's an odd thing and I don't really know what's to be done about it because there are stories about African Americans that are not written by African Americans. Those are considered for everybody. I don't know what that's all about. I don't know.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Just one more, two more.
Two more questions. Kim, how about right over here in the pink purple shirt?
Hi, Ms. Jones. I'm one of your father's students.
You are not alone in this room.
I'm from Clark Atlanta University. Yeah, I haven't seen you since you were a little girl. And I always like to ask writers about your process of writing. I think it's always interesting. You write in the morning, you write every day. How do you get inspired? I know you just mentioned your last book, but I mean, where you get the ideas to come up with these colorful stories?
I like to write in the mornings when I can, but what I have found is that for me, the less likes I have, the more likely I am to write because, okay, if I say I can only write in the morning, then afternoon, if I have free time, I can't use it for writing because I've told myself I'm a morning writer. You see, so I try not to have things that I require. But if it was, you know, up to me in the world, I like to write. I do prefer to write in the morning, but I do like a clean room. I can't write in clutter. I need a clean room. And my writing area is the only such space in my home. I have clutter everywhere else. If my daddy were to hear me say I can't write in clutter, he'd be shocked because he's like, you do everything in clutter. Look at your car. But I like to write in a clean room in the morning, and I like to drink a lot of coffee. Now, that's what I do. I like to drink. I mean, if I could figure out how to put my coffee in an IV, I would, you know, just go straight for it. But what I do try to think about, really, and I tell this to other people about writing, is that a lot of people feel like, you know, Virginia Woolf said you have to have a room of your own to be a writer. A writer needs a room of her own. And then that makes people think, wow, if I don't have a room for writing, I can't write. Or if you have a job, you know, if you have kids, if you don't have time, that I figure out how to write in whatever time is available to me. And that's what other people can too. If you don't have a lot of time, it'll take you longer to finish, but you still can finish. Because I feel like the people who don't have a lot of time, they don't have a lot of time because they're out living our important American lives that need to be recorded. And those are the people who think they can't record their story, but that it just takes more time, but you can, that you will do it. I feel that whatever your writing practice is, you should honor it. What I have been doing, I try to write 4 hours a week. And those are the 4 hours that other people go to the gym. You know, you're supposed to go to the gym 4 hours a week. In lieu of that, instead of a Zumba class, I try to make sure I get at least those 4 hours in. And if I can get 4 hours in a week, I make slow progress toward my goal. I teach, you know. I'm in the family business. I'm a professor, too. And at the end of the school year, when it's summertime, I have all this time, and then I zoom through. But I just use those 4 hours a week to keep edging toward my goal until I have the time to dedicate it.
All right. Last question. There's a man about 10 rows back right over there.
Hello, and thank you for fielding my question. I really enjoyed that. Tiara, I did get to read some of Returning to Atlanta, from Atlanta?
Leaving Atlanta,
excuse me. A little nervous, I really enjoyed it. The description and dealing, the little girl dealing with the parents splitting and all of that was so vivid. It was amazing. I just wanted a quick question about marginalization and shame that you both touched on as themes. And I saw it in part as a metaphor for a broader marginalization and shame of a community that is often not at all embraced in academic institutional circles. And I thought that perhaps in that there might be also a solution to some of the lack to some of the commercial aspects. My question is, what can be done to share some of this writing in earlier educational levels, in much the way that, for instance, some people use urban fiction or use folk writings, things like Tom Sawyer, to open up, to bridge the lives of the youth with the academic lives of the classroom. And perhaps, in so doing, also serve the purpose of building a natural audience to buy these books. I don't know if that was clear. What can be done to bring more of this in the classroom? Because I think there can be a lot. The same way that you shine light on your marginalized characters, there are real people who will identify with those characters who never see themselves represented in their academic texts and who are alienated from the classroom. Many of them are urban youth of color. Is that clear?
I think that's really important. I mean, I've banned my students from ever using the word relatable, mostly because it's not a word, but also because like it never means what they think they mean when they say it. But there's a way in which I think that idea of recognition, that idea going back to that idea of kind of comforting the afflicted, afflicting the comfortable, that somebody else, that feeling you thought was the only, you were the only person in the world who'd ever felt the thing that you felt had only happened to you, knowing that it exists in some other space, that someone's put a name to it, I think is a really important function of literature, and one we sometimes downplay because we talk about the kind of the broader effects, the afflicting, the comfortable, the opening horizons part of literature, but we don't talk about how important it is to kind of recognize yourself in a space. And I know that as a writer, I think when I was talking about kind of giving myself permission to take myself seriously as a writer in college, a lot of that was because I'd read books that took place in a world that I recognized for the first time. And I went through a really good school system and had, in general, really good, generous teachers, but I really thought if I want to write about black people, this novel is going to have to be about slavery, because I didn't know that there were kind of books that took contemporary African-American life seriously in any way. That just knowing that space existed and no one had sort of showed it to me before was really important. And so I think part of it is just talking to people, making sure that space is available, telling people what's out there, giving people, like I do, I always get people do their Christmas shopping and they're like shopping for months and I'm confused because I do all of my Christmas shopping at like the bookstore 2 days before Christmas. But you can find something for everybody to kind of connect to and really, and I am a thoughtful book giver. I don't just give everybody the same book, but it's not like I give everyone my book. But there's a way in which I think thinking about, you know, you should really read this. It can be as simple as that, kind of expanding that conversation so it doesn't feel like work. Because I think for a lot of my students, like when they read something contemporary, they come in with a bit of resistance, and then it doesn't feel like work. And it doesn't have to be contemporary, but there are all of these ways in which people find themselves in stories, and sometimes in ways that surprise me. I mean, I teach African-American literature in a school with not a lot of African-American students, but the ways the students come to me with, like, I'm glad somebody finally put that feeling into words, and I think, really, okay. And that's what it's there for, you know?
I think the key to getting the work in the classroom is, might not be in the classroom. I think that mentorship is really going to be the key. In New York, I work with an organization called Girls Write Now, Write with a W, and we match teen girls with writing mentors. I was the vice chair of the board. I stepped down in order to promote my book, so I took a leave of absence from the organization. But only 48% of girls in New York City public schools finish high school. 48%, okay. Less than half. Because the girls with money go to private schools. So only 48%. So we take teen girls, very simple thing. We take teen girls, we match them with a writing mentor. Usually it could be a woman who's maybe 25. Some of them are all the way up to 75, like grandmother age. But just matching them, they meet once a week. They write together. Sometimes they collaborate. Sometimes they do separate projects. They read books together. They talk about them together. 100% of the girls and girls right now have finished high school this year, and 100% of our girls are going to college this year. I mean, and the credit all goes to our mentors who are volunteers. These women volunteer their time. We're almost an all-volunteer organization. But we have, like, events, readings where, you know, established writers read. We should get Danielle to read to them. Like Danielle would read. Like when Danielle reads next year in the series, she would read for 10 minutes. And then the girls would read after, so they get a chance to read to someone who's not, like, not like their mothers, not like coming to, like, a recital at a high school, but, like, they're reading to the world. And we give away books as prizes. And these, our girls are just about reading and about writing. And it is really changing the trajectory of their lives. Because if you send someone to college and no one in their family has ever been to college, you have changed the trajectory of the life for a whole family. So we think about, like, the whole, we use books as part of the whole picture as to how to change their lives. And I am such a believer in mentorship because of my experience with this program. You should look at it online, Girls Write Now with a W. You can see videos. It's really amazing.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Let's all please thank Danielle and Terry.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.